Well, glad you were here tonight. It'd be kind of lonely without you. I've asked the guys to put my email address up there. Why would you want that? Good question. You may have a question that you don't get the chance to ask this week, or it might occur to you next week, and I'm not going to be here next week. But I will be on the end of email pretty well every day throughout the year. And if there's something you think you would like to know, either from myself or from Eva, just email us and we'll get back to you. Another reason you might like it... Oh, my wife's going to leave. Yeah, thanks. I travel throughout the year. I don't have a church of my own. I would make a dreadful pastor, which is probably why I'm not one. But I do preach probably on average about 3 times every day through the year. And if you think I could be of help in the church you attend or some project you're involved in, whether it's a youth project or a missions project, then get in touch. If you don't, I won't know and I won't come. You might think that could be expensive, and it could be, but I don't charge anything, either travel or salary, and never charge anything, never ask for anything. If it's specifically missionary, even if they offer something, I won't accept it. So you can think about that. God underwrites the ministry. He's been faithful for 49 years, he'll probably make it through another year or two. And he's not hard up, whatever anybody else says. He really isn't. So take advantage of that if it's a benefit at all. The title we're going under this week is Adventuring with Jesus. Thinking particularly, as Jesus said, as the Father sent me, so I send you. Jesus was dependent on the Father. He is God. He's always been God. He's never been less than God. But while he was here, he surrendered the use of all his divine attributes and lived as no more than man, playing by exactly the same rules that you have to play by, which is why he can say to you, as the Father sent me, that's how I'm sending you. He had nothing going for him that you don't have going for you. In fact, you've got more going for you than he had, because you live after Jesus. You live after Calvary. You have a New Testament. He didn't have a New Testament. He didn't even have a personal copy of the Old Testament. And at Calvary, Jesus won the battle. They're still mopping up operations, but the battle was decided between Calvary and the resurrection. You live after that. He lived before it. You have more going for you than he had going for him. And subconsciously, a lot of Christians think like this. I'd expect Jesus to be wonderful because he's God. He'd always know what to say. He'd always know what to do. He could do miracles. But you wouldn't expect much from me now, would you? Because I'm not Jesus. And it's a giant cop-out. Because you have everything that Jesus is living in you. Just before Eva comes to read the scripture, I thought I would tell you an Irish story. Since I got at the Scots yesterday, it must be time for the Irish. And these two middle-aged guys meet where all Irishmen meet. If you don't know where that is, you can find tall black glasses of Guinness on the bench. And they are eyeing each other suspiciously. And after about an hour of this, one finally says to the other, "Hey, is that you, Sean?" "I am Sean." "And you must be Michael. We were in high school together." "Hey, I'm Michael." Man, you've aged. That's enough of that. Look at you. Wrinkles all over your face. Them's not wrinkles. Them's laugh lines. Nay, nothing could be that funny. What are you doing these days? I'm writing poetry. Poetry, is it? And how's it going? I'm stuck. You're stuck? I'm stuck. And what are you stuck on? I can't find anything to rhyme with great. Great? That's ridiculous. There's hundreds of words rhyme with great. Well, I just need one. Okay, how about fascinate? 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 Fascinate. Fascinate. You're a genius. I can finish my poem now. Do you want to hear it? Well, of course. I have a lovely overcoat. I really think it's great. It has 9 buttons down the front, but I can only... You can explain it to the rest tomorrow.
And if you thought that was a genuine Irish accent, here's a real one. The scripture reading this evening is again another familiar story from Luke chapter 5, beginning at verse 17. One day as Jesus was teaching, Pharisees and teachers of the law, who had come from every village of Galilee and from Judea and Jerusalem, were sitting there. And the power of the Lord was present for him to heal the sick. Some men came carrying a paralytic on a mat and tried to take him into the house to lay him before Jesus. When they couldn't find a way to do this because of the crowd, they went up on the roof and lowered him on his mat through the tiles into the middle of the crowd, right in front of Jesus. When Jesus saw their faith, he said, "Friend, your sins are forgiven." The Pharisees and the teachers of the law began thinking to themselves, "Who's this fellow who speaks blasphemy? Who can forgive sins but God alone?" Jesus knew what they were thinking and asked, "Why are you thinking these things in your hearts? Which is easier, to say, 'Your sins are forgiven,' or to say, 'Get up and walk'? But that you may know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins," he said to the paralyzed man, "I tell you, get up, take your mat, and go home." Immediately, he stood up in front of them, took what he had been lying on, and went home praising God. Everyone was amazed and gave praise to God. They were filled with awe and said, "We have seen remarkable things today." Lord, may your word live in us and bear much fruit to your glory.
You may have wondered why there are 4 Gospels. And Tom Warner didn't know there were 2 Testaments, so it's reasonable that some people wouldn't know there are 4 Gospels. Why? Well, each one emphasizes a different aspect of Jesus. They aren't contradictory. One or two small things appear to be on the surface, but then when you look a little more deeper, then a whole new meaning comes out, and they're not contradictory at all. And that's amazing in itself. Four accounts of the same life that don't contradict each other. Matthew emphasizes Jesus, the King of the Jews, and is writing primarily for Jews. Mark is writing primarily for Romans and emphasizes Jesus as the ideal servant. John emphasizes Jesus as the Son of God who has come from heaven. And Luke emphasizes Jesus as the perfect man, and he's writing essentially for the Greeks. And Luke is a doctor. He accompanies Paul on some of Paul's missions, mainly toward the end of his life. And he is giving a first-hand account of some of Paul's missions in the book of Acts. He also is a doctor and therefore is a scientist and a man of careful intellectual scientific habits. And he gives you details of Jesus' healing miracles and of the resurrection and of his birth that others don't give you. And he begins the book saying, "I have carefully researched everything from the beginning. And I want you to know the certainty of these things. It's not just an idea. It's certain, definite, fact." And Luke arranges his material in a way that the others don't. And Luke's Gospel, chapter 5, compresses five incidents. Almost as you read it, it feels as though they all happened the same day. They couldn't have. But he wants them all together because together they make a significant impact that individually they don't. And the first one is a businessman whom we know as Peter. His business is catching and marketing fish. The second one is a leper. The third one you just heard read about, a paralyzed man. The fourth one is a tax collector called Levi, whom you've heard of because he invented blue jeans. And, oh, sorry, that was a different one. And then there's a bunch of people at the end called they. And of course, all of us are individuals, and Jesus deals with us as individuals. He doesn't deal with you the same way as he deals with me or anybody else. He tells us like this. He calls his own sheep by name. Our neighbor in Ireland, nearest neighbor, has about 4,000 sheep. He doesn't have names for them. He just sends the dogs out and the dogs bring them. Jesus calls each individual by name. He knows your name. He knows who you are. He knows all your mental and emotional struggles. He knows your history, your family history. He knows your hopes. He knows your most shameful secrets and your highest ambitions. Loves you in spite of all of it. And he wants you to see yourself somewhere in here, not as identical to any of these people, but perhaps with a point of contact. Businessmen normally are pretty hard to get to. They're busy, they are self-reliant, and if things aren't going too well, they'll redouble their efforts to try and make sure they do go well. It's hard to even see them. You've got to make an appointment with their secretary. And yet God has a way of getting to everybody. He knows where you live. He knows what you do. And he's about to get into Peter's life, and Peter's no idea. He's been out fishing, and he's Galilee's number one fisherman. He has a partner called Zebedee. And if I didn't have my own name, I think that's the name I would like to have. Partly, they would only get to you at the end of the class. And so, they've been out fishing all night and caught nothing. And they've redoubled their efforts as the night goes on. And they move around to different parts of the lake where they know there are fish. Nothing. And this is seriously frustrating. It's bad news for business. And at last, exhausted, they come into the shore in the dawn, and they start getting their nets ready for the next night's fishing. And Peter's already done that, and he ought to go home and have a rest, ready to go again. But he doesn't go. Maybe, I don't know why, but I know some homes are more restful than others. And it might be that his home was not particularly restful. I did hear of one couple driving along, having, to use a polite word, a discussion. And the temperature was rising with every mile they drove. They passed a field with a couple of donkeys in it. And he indicated the donkeys and he said, "Relatives of yours, dear?" "Yes," she said, "on my husband's side of the family." They went a little further and he exploded and he said, "I cannot understand. It totally baffles me why God would make you at one and the same time so beautiful and so stupid." She said, "Well, it's very easy. He made me beautiful so that you'd want to marry me, and stupid so that I would want to marry you." And it may be that Peter's home was a bit like that. And he's exhausted, and he's a failure, and he doesn't want to go home and say so. Maybe his wife wouldn't even believe him. She'd think, "What have you done with the money?" So he's not home. He's sitting in his boat, and he gets trapped there because the father brings Jesus along the shore. And all these crowds are pressing in, wanting to listen to him. And the same four big guys elbow their way to the front, and the rest of the people can't see, and Jesus can't see them, and he wants eye contact, and they've had garlic for breakfast, and they're in his face, and he keeps stepping backwards to get a little air and a little opportunity to see everybody. And then he spots Peter's boat and thinks, the ideal thing, and gets into it. "Would you mind just going out a bit further? And I'll teach the people from your boat. They won't follow me into the water. They'll all be able to see and hear, and I'll be able to breathe, and you're not doing anything anyway, are you? Thank you." And this is not great news for Peter, because at this time, Peter is not a disciple. And he doesn't have any faith in Jesus. And this is an interruption at a time when he least needs an interruption. He's in a bad temper, exhausted, and he would love to tell Jesus to get out and get lost. But it's a big crowd, and they are not well-behaved Minnesotans. They are emotional people from the Middle East, excitable people, kind of like English soccer fans, if you've ever heard of those. And if there's a lot of them and only one of you, you don't antagonize them. So he does what he's been asked. He doesn't want to listen. The last thing he needs. And he sits there dozing off and half waking. You know how it feels, don't you? I can see you do. And and he sort of jerks awake, and the sun's beating down on the back of his head now, and day's warming up, and he's got a headache, and he's trapped in his own boat. And Jesus seems to go on for an awfully long time. And finally, Jesus tells the people they can go away, and Peter thinks, "Great, let me go too. I need to get home. I need to get rest. I need some food." When Jesus turns and says, "Why don't you go out a bit further and we'll do some fishing?" This is not a welcome suggestion. In fact, it's about the dumbest suggestion Peter's ever heard. He's the expert. He knows how to fish. This guy has never been fishing in his life. He's a carpenter. Any idiot knows you go during the night when it's cool. Go out in a day like this with blazing sun, the fish will see the boats and nets from miles away, won't come anywhere near. What dumb suggestion. Well, all right, then I'll prove it to you. And he rows out a bit further with steam blowing out of the ears every pull on the oars. And of course, you know what happens? They make the biggest catch they've ever seen. And Peter suddenly realizes he's been entirely wrong about Jesus. And while that morning Jesus was just a nuisance and interference in his life, now that he has a new appraisal of who Jesus is, and if he's right about fishing and I'm the expert, but he's better than I am, maybe he's better than the priests and the rabbis. Maybe he's right about that too. And Peter did something very untypical of a businessman or a fisherman. He left everything to go with Jesus. Fishermen don't normally do that. I was in the office of a pastor in Canada some years ago, and his personal office was about twice the size of this platform. And two whole walls were covered in glass cases with stuffed fish in them. And he was quite prepared to take the entire day and give me the personal history of every fish. That's a fisherman. He's a businessman with a golden opportunity to make some serious money. Biggest catch he's ever seen in his life. Kind of thing he dreams about. Market just down the road waiting. And he walked away from it. Because now that he understands what Jesus is really worth, nothing else matters. And he left everything to go with Jesus. And not all of us are called to do that physically, but all of us are called to do that in our hearts. Jesus is supremely important. Anyone who loves anybody else or anything else more than me is not worthy of me. Simple. Next person is a leper. This came real for me in India. And I hadn't really expected to meet a leper. Didn't really want to, if I'm honest. And it came at a time for me, it was kind of a bit like the time for Peter. It had been a busy week. I'd been in a place called Emmanuel Bible College in Kota, and they had 850 undergraduate students, 50 postgraduate students, 50 staff, an orphanage and a trade school. And my day started at 6 a.m. and I had 6 one-hour lectures with all the undergrads, all the postgrads and all the staff. 6 one-hour lectures between 6 a.m. and 1. No sound system, no air conditioning. It was about 98 degrees. No fan. But that was just the morning. In the afternoon, they had about 1,800 kids in the orphanage, and I had an hour with them. Then they had about 60 kids in their trade school, and I had an hour with them. All afternoon, the students were out scouring the town, bringing in as many people as they could. And we had an evening meeting starting at 7, running on till about 10, with somewhere between 4,000 and 6,000 people every night, still no microphone. And then we had a prayer time from 10 till midnight. And then I was off again at 6 o'clock the next morning. So it was a reasonably busy week. Saturday I didn't have to teach in the school. I only had to preach 3 times, But it was in the open air, and we walked probably about 8 miles under the Indian sun and from marketplace to marketplace, doing open air meetings and talking with individuals. Saturday night, I traveled by train into New Delhi, and it was not a first-class train by any means. There was a little narrow wooden bench seat, and I was kind of perched on that. And two guys whom I didn't know, but next to me, pressing in on me, and we were exchanging sweat the whole distance. Somebody else standing in front of me with part of his anatomy in my face that I preferred not to think about. And in another sense, I was alone, in that I knew nobody there. And when you travel like that in India, if you want to arrive with anything more than your underwear, you don't go to sleep. And I was attached to things like my passport and air tickets and things like that. So I stayed awake, bouncing around on this wooden seat all night, traveling into Delhi, and arrived there about 8 o'clock in the morning. And I had 3 meetings to speak at Sunday morning. Sunday afternoon, according to my program, I had a free afternoon, and I was thinking about getting reacquainted with the bed. I was having lunch with the pastor at the time, and he said, "I haven't committed you to anything this afternoon." And I said, "That's a real shame." And then he said, "But there's something I'd like you to do." And I thought, "Uh-oh, better get an excuse ready here." And he said, "I'd like you to go with me to a leper colony." And I thought, if there's one place I never really want to go, it's a leper colony. And if there's one time in my life I really don't want to go, it's right now. And the longer he talked, the worse it sounded. It was going to be a 45-minute ride on the back of his motorbike. See, and not the very center of downtown, but all the rest of the town. The side of the road is a public toilet. See? And in the morning, it's not too bad. It's sort of wet and heavy and just lies there. But by the afternoon, it's dried out and it all swirls around. It's dusty and you can breathe it in if you want to. And there's not much protection on the back of a motorbike. The bike was 22 years old. The pastor was 21 years old. And there were a lot of reasons I could see for not doing this. But none of them were quite good enough, so I thought, okay, let's do it. And so we headed for the leper colony. And we were still nearly a quarter of a mile away from it when I smelt it for the first time. See, and India is not poor in smells, it's rich in smells, and curry is the least of them. But this was absolutely indescribable. And all I was doing by the time we arrived there was to try to hold my lunch down. And it didn't want to stay down. It was really intent on getting out. And as we pulled in and I got off the bike, this man came toward me and he'd had leprosy for a while and he was badly affected by it. He had no fingers and no thumbs, kind of oozing stumps, and no ears and no nose. And what you could see of his face was all affected by the disease. And if you can imagine this, he came forward and smiled. He had no features, but he smiled. And he held out the stump because he wanted to shake hands. I didn't. I almost went into shock. I took a giant step backwards. And then I felt really guilty, and I thought, you know, Jesus wouldn't have done that. Jesus would shake this guy's hand. Therefore, I will do it. And I transmitted this message to my reluctant body. And I said, feet walk forward, and they didn't want to. I had to push them. Hand, shake the stump. Oh, you're joking. No, I'm not. And I took hold of the stump, thinking I was ready to become the next saint, or at least appear on the front page of the newspaper with Mother Teresa, when I made a serious error. I looked in the man's eyes. And what I saw when I looked in his eyes was deep hurt. and I was responsible for it. See, I have no way of knowing this, but the man was the only Christian out of 450 lepers in that colony. He'd been told the previous Sunday, it's just possible that the Bible teacher from England will come and hold a meeting here. All week he'd been praying, God, send this brother to me. It is so lonely here. I need encouragement. I need fellowship. And when he heard the motorbike, he thought, wow, my prayers have been answered. And he came forward to meet his brother and smiled. That's what you do, isn't it? And wanted to shake hands. And my response was probably worse than a slap in the face. That helped me understand this leper in Luke chapter 5. Because people then were even more ignorant and prejudiced than I am. Parents taught their kids how to recognize a leper. A leper had to wear specific, easily recognizable clothing. He had to carry a little bell and ring it if anybody was in earshot so they would know there was a leper. If anybody still got too close, he had to shout out, unclean! And people avoided lepers. They wouldn't even let their shadow touch the shadow of the leper. They shrank away from them across the road. Parents instructed their kids, the same kids when they went to school were taught by the rabbis, never go near a leper. But somebody had told this leper about Jesus. And they'd done a wonderful job telling him about the power and the authority of Jesus. Because this leper believed without any doubt that Jesus had the power to heal him. If you're willing, you can make me whole. Not just arrest the progress of the disease, but restore everything that was missing. However, whoever told him about Jesus, while they'd done a terrific job on the power of Jesus, had done a pathetic job on the personality of Jesus. Because the man still has a doubt. If you are willing, I know you can. Now, if you'd never heard this story, but you read all the other parts of all four Gospels and knew them really well, but you were coming to this point for the first time, how would you expect Jesus to respond to this? If you are willing, you can make me whole. Well, no, frankly, I don't feel like it today. Would you expect that? Oh, why don't you see my secretary, see if you can get an appointment? Come back tomorrow. Well, no, really, this is not the kind of thing I want to get into. Be totally out of character, wouldn't it? In fact, Jesus is a bit shocked. Willing? Of course I'm willing. And he does something unthinkable in that culture. He reaches out and touches the leper. Nobody did that. It wasn't necessary to do that in order to heal his leprosy. Jesus could just have said, be healed, and he would have been. Or go and wash in the River Jordan, he would have been. The leprosy didn't need Jesus to touch him. So why is Jesus touching him? Was he not paying attention when Mary and Joseph told him, never touch a leper? Was he asleep in class with the rabbi? Why in that culture, when everything said, don't touch a leper, is Jesus touching this leper? See, when he does this, he bridges an enormous gulf. You can almost hear the gasp of astonishment in the crowd. Did you see that? He touched him. He didn't need to do that to heal his leprosy. He needed to do that to heal the man emotionally and psychologically. And he's transmitting the message to you and me. You may think you're a long distance away. You feel that you're so disgusting, I wouldn't come anywhere near you. And when he reaches out, he bridges this enormous gulf and he touches the man with the hand motivated by his father. And God is touching the leper. And he's transmitting a message of how much Jesus and the Father want to reach you and me and everybody, no matter how disgusting we might be. Then there's a paralyzed guy. And he's got four friends. I love these guys. We don't know who they were. We're not told. Four men, but they had faith. And in those days, being paralyzed, well, a paralyzed person had one asset. He could beg. And the more hideous the disease, the more fruitful it was for begging purposes. But they couldn't do anything else. See, then they have wheelchairs. Paralyzed people couldn't paint with a paintbrush held in their teeth or write beautiful music or books like Johnny Erickson Tada. Paralyzed people were just a total burden on their family. If they wanted to turn over, somebody had to pick them up and turn them over. If they wanted to go to the bathroom, somebody had to carry them there, clean them up and carry them back again. If they were going to eat, somebody had to spoon feed every spoonful. Total burden, useless. And the friends say, we're going to take you to Jesus. And you can hear the guy saying, what for? It's not going to do any good, you know. I'm paralyzed. Well, we're taking you anyway. And they pick him up and carry him, of course. He's paralyzed, he can't resist. And they get to the house where Jesus is and they can't get in. They can't even get close to the house. People spilling out of the doors and crowding around the windows where, of course, there's no glass and the house itself is packed with people. And they've all come to listen to Jesus. And they can't get in. Certainly not with a stretcher. See, I told you, it's no good. Take me home again. So they took him on the roof. What are we going up here for? And then they started breaking up the roof. Hey, you can't do that. This roof belongs to somebody. He's going to be mad. Found myself wondering what I would have thought if it had been my roof. But if it had been my roof, there would have been a problem. Before we moved to Ireland, we lived in a village called Silverdale in England. Nice little village. And I was traveling probably 11 months out of 12 overseas. And I was in Denmark at the time, it was early October, and my wife phoned me. And there's a lady living in Silverdale called Mrs. Bright. It's a very good name. She was full of bright ideas. She just had one. She phoned my wife, who was now phoning me. There was a man in the village about to go to prison. He had a wife and three daughters. They wouldn't be able to keep up their house payments. Mrs. Bright thought it would be a good idea if we would take them in. So my wife phoned me and said, what do you think? And I knew what I thought. I thought it was a seriously dumb idea. We usually have students to stay with us over Christmas because they have to leave the Bible school. And so maybe Christmas, maybe New Year. We one of the ways we use our home is to have people in for meals and get to know them. And we wouldn't be able to do any of that if we had four extra people staying. And I said, do you know the people? No, I've never met him. Do you know what he's done? Don't know what he's done. How long has he gone to prison for? 3 months. Well, it's October, they'll let him out for Christmas. Do we want extra people in the house over Christmas? When he comes out of jail, do we tell him he can come as well? Or do we tell him he can't come but will keep his family? You know? Or if he comes as well, will we ever get him out again? And I think about my diary. You know, I'm going to be gone from mid-January to end of April. Do I want this man staying in my house with my wife when I'm not there? And if my wife joins me for a little bit, do we leave them in the house? Will we have a house when we go back? And then I remember Mrs. Bright has a bigger house than we do. If these are such nice people, why doesn't she take them in? So I was about to say to my wife, this is really not a good idea, when I thought I should ask the owner. See, I paid the mortgage, but I always said Jesus owned it. So I said, Jesus, this is really a daft idea, isn't it? And he said, take them in. And we won't be able to have other people in, take them in. And what about Christmas and then take them in? And I hope you know what you... Take them in! So they moved in early October. He came out of prison December the 23rd, moved in as well. 3rd of January, sat on the bottom step of the staircase with their youngest girl, who was 8. And she prayed to receive Jesus. A little later, the middle girl did too. People became very close friends. When they got to the point where they could afford their own home, they bought the one across the road, so they wouldn't be very far away from us. They took care of the yard when we were away and the animals. Some of the best friends we had in that village. See, if it had been my house, there would have been a problem. Same with this one. But these four guys had faith in Jesus, and the man who owned the house had made the house available to Jesus. And if the paralyzed man needed Jesus and the roof was in the way, you take the roof off. Where's the problem? So let me ask you, whose house do you live in? Whose money do you manage? Whose vehicle do you drive? So they take off the roof and they lower down on his stretcher the paralyzed guy. And the house is packed with people. I mean, they can't even move. And Jesus is in the middle of trying to teach. And bits of roof start falling in. You know, dust and straw and lumps of clay and the odd scorpion. And it caused quite a disturbance. I think people lost concentration in the class. Jesus was a great teacher. But imagine this happening in your Sunday school class. And they're trying to get out of the way and squeeze back against the wall. Some of them are lumps on their heads where the roofs hit them. And others are trying to get scorpions out of their shirts. And others are really angry. Just my luck. Walked 5 miles to get here this morning. I've waited weeks to hear this guy. He's just getting interesting. And these hooligans come. And as they take the roof off, the sun blasts through. And it's like a spotlight on a stage. in a dark little house. And in the middle of the spotlight comes a paralyzed guy, embarrassed out of his wits, can't even turn his face away, and he lands on the floor in front of Jesus, and everybody's staring. And what Jesus saw was their faith. Do you have the kind of faith that can be seen? And he says to the paralyzed man, "Hey, you, stand up, pick your bed up, take it home." And there's a little cluster of muttering Pharisees at the back of the room who are there to find fault with Jesus. And they're muttering to each other in this secret little enclave, "Who does this guy think he is? Sins are forgiven? Who but God can forgive sins? This is blasphemy." And Jesus knows what they're thinking. See? Now, suppose I were to come up to you and punch you in the nose, and your nose goes flat, and the blood runs down, and the front teeth get loose. And then I study you carefully, and I say with great perception, "You're upset, aren't you? Boy, don't you get upset easily. It only took a second. But since you're upset, I suppose we should do something. I mean, I don't think it's important at all, but you do. So we probably should do something. So here's what we'll do. I forgive me, okay?" Yeah. "You're still upset. Boy, you're a difficult person. Okay, here's what I'll do then. I will go down the road and I'll see the priest and I'll tell the priest and the priest will forgive me. Okay?" You still look upset. And you're thinking, "But it's my nose." And you have a point. At least you did before I flattened it. And you're thinking, "It's my nose. I'm the only person that can do the forgiving." Is that what you're thinking? But see, all sin is against God, isn't it? It is a flouting of his authority. A violation of his holiness. An affront to his majesty. And if you have a problem with God, you have an infinite problem. Because you have an infinite God. And if you don't think it's important, that's just your opinion. If you think you can forgive yourself, it's not great thinking. And the priest can't do it for you either. All sin is against God. So the Pharisees have a point. Only God can forgive sins, of course. But Jesus says, "I know what you're thinking." How does he know? Father tells him. "So what you're thinking, isn't it? Only God can forgive sins? All right then. You, stand up, pick your bed up, take it home. So that they might know then, and you and I might know now, that Jesus has authority from heaven to forgive sins here and now. You don't have to wait till you die. Watch that guy walk out of there. And you know, Jesus can do this." The next one is Levi. He's a tax collector. He has denied his religion and his race. Tax collectors were the most hated people in their society. They're not particularly popular in your society, or mine for that matter. Not many Christians I know say, "Hallelujah, I can pay my taxes again. Isn't it great?" Probably not. But the point there was the taxes were taken from the holy people and given to the heathen people, the Romans. Taken from their own people and given to the enemy. This is what Levi was doing. And he hides behind bodyguards because tax collectors always had cash. That's how people paid. And there were plenty of people more than happy to relieve a tax collector of the money he had. They hid from society behind bodyguards. And Jesus saw Levi right in the middle of his table in front of him, little piles of money, bodyguards around. He says, "Hey, Levi, I want you." And Levi, like Peter, left everything to go with Jesus. Putting these people together, each one has a question that expects no for an answer. Peter's question is, "You would not want me, would you?" He puts it this way, "You better go away because I'm a sinful man. You wouldn't want me around, I'm rotten, you better leave. You wouldn't want me, would you?" The leper's question is this, "You wouldn't touch me, would you?" Nobody touches lepers. The paralyzed guy's question is this, "You couldn't use me, could you? Paralyzed people are useless. And I'm worse than useless. I've bust up your lesson." Levi's question is, "You wouldn't be my friend, would you? Tax collectors have forfeited all friendship. They hate it." And each one of these expects no for an answer. But each one, surprisingly, gets yes for an answer. "Yes, Peter, I want you. Come with me. From now on, you're going to catch me. Yes, Mr. Leper, I will touch you and I will make you whole. You won't be a leper anymore. You can take your full place in society." "Wrong, Mr. Paralyzed Man. You think you're useless, you're an interruption in my lesson. Wrong, you are my lesson." Luke doesn't bother to tell us what Jesus was teaching. I'm sure it was good. But what Jesus was teaching is not what you and I need to know. What you and I need to know is what happened with the leper. And the leper becomes a demonstration for them then and for us now. Here's how you know that Jesus can forgive sins. Because there are no useless people in Jesus' economy. In fact, the weaker we are, the greater his opportunity, because his strength is made perfect in our weakness. Do you qualify? Isn't that great? "Yes, Levi, I will be your friend. I will be the kind of friend you've never even dreamed of. Because I will introduce you to my Father in the presence of the angels in glory. Yes, I want you. Yes, I will touch you and make you whole. Yes, I will use you in ways you've never even dreamed of, in countries you've never even heard of." Don't think the paralyzed guy had heard of America. Or even Britain. "Yes, Levi, I want to be your friend. Never leave you or forsake you, but be with you 24/7 until I present you to my Father as my brother. Invite you to share my throne as I overcame and am sat with my Father in his throne." That's quite a transformation, isn't it? Tax collector to sharing the throne of the King of Kings. Which brings us to the bunch of people at the end called they. And they're not identified, but here they are. And they come to Jesus and they say, "Jesus, we've got a problem, you're it. Because we don't know where to stuff you. We have to stuff you somewhere. We've got this system of pigeonholes, and we stuff everybody in one somewhere so that we know where to find them and we know where to leave them. And that's what we want to do with you, Jesus, because there might be times when we need you. We might need to be healed or something. So it'd be really nice if we knew where to find you when we need you. But then there will be other times when your presence would be an embarrassment because of the kind of things we get up to sometimes. So we need to know where to stuff you to get rid of you when we don't want you. So we thought, well, he's religious. The Pharisees are religious. So stuff him in the Pharisee slot, but you wouldn't fit that one. You're not like the Pharisees. So I thought, not like the Pharisees. John the Baptist, he's religious, but not like the Pharisees. Stuff him in with John the Baptist. But John the Baptist was a teetotaler, and you drink. You don't fit the John the Baptist slot. You're really difficult, and we don't know where to stick you. So tell us, where do we stuff you? And Jesus' response seems to be a bit irrelevant. He says, no man puts new wine in old wineskins. What's that got to do with John the Baptist and the Pharisees? Well, you see, new wine is still fermenting. Chemical process, biochemical happening, generating little bubbles of gas. Those older ones know what that's like. And sorry. It must be a hangover from last night. Blame her. New wine is still generating gas. An old wineskin is a dried out leather bottle which is rigid. A new one is still elastic and will stretch. There's power in fermenting wine. My dad used to make elderberry wine every year in the fall. And he made it in that room under the house, an air raid shelter. And he made it in a cask that was about this big, and it was made of inch-thick yellow pot with bamboo woven around it with carrying handles in it. And one year he corked it up too soon. Now normally there were potations and libations and incantations and recriminations, occasionally celebrations. This year he corked it up too soon. And immediately above the air raid shelter was the dining room. And we were having dinner one night, I was 9, my sister was 16, when there was an explosion that rocked the house. And I thought it was a distant atom bomb, but prosaic sister said it was in the cellar. So we went down there, and this cask had exploded. And there were pieces of yellow pottery embedded in the plaster in the ceiling and the walls, and had taken chips out of a polished concrete floor. And there were elderberries everywhere. And if anyone had been in there, they'd have been killed. See, there is power in fermenting wine. And when Jesus says, no one puts new wine in old wineskin, he knows what he's saying. They explode. So. What is he saying? He's saying, I'm the living God. When you're dealing with me, you're dealing with power. Serious power. If you know Einstein's formula, E equals mc squared, what is the mass of the universe? And how do you create that out of nothing? With a whole lot of energy is the answer. When you're dealing with God, you're dealing with power. And Jesus is saying, you cannot contain me in any system. You can't make me a Baptist or a Methodist. Or a Pentecostal. You can't say, God, I give you my Sundays, you can have all day, just stay out of 6 days. You can't say, God, I'll give you my first waking hour every day, I'll handle the rest. You can't say, God, help me with my family because they're really difficult, but stay out of my television life. Don't mess with my computer. God, help me switch off the TV when I need to. Put a guard on my computer. Don't tell me how to spend my money. I can do that. I can't say, God, help me with my finances. Help me in my work. Just don't tell me how I should be with my family. You don't understand. Can't do any of those things. There's no wineskin that's going to contain Jesus. There's no pigeonhole you can stick him in and say, I'll take you out when I want you and put you back when I don't. I'm God. You want me or not? I want you. I want you. I'll touch you and make you whole. I'll use you in ways you never imagined you could use. I will be your friend for time and eternity. But no, you will not be in charge of the relationship. I will be. I'm the Lord. Do you want me? Yes or no? Do you want a life filled with the radiance of the living God? Or do you just want to be a good church member? Do you want to continue life as it is, with just a little help in a couple of areas where you know you need it? Or do you really want Jesus? As the Father sent me, so I send you. And I'm not telling you where yet. I'll unfold it day by day. There'll be some surprises, some shocks. It's going to be exciting. Because there's all kinds of people I want to get to through you. All sorts of projects I have in mind through you. I know the plans I have for you to give you a future and a hope. So do you want Jesus? Yes or no? That's the question. It's the only question, really. Let's take 30 seconds of silence and let you process this. Do you want Jesus? Yes or no?